Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's hunger crisis is boiling over and a leading trade union slams corporate greed. New emission rules could see carbon culprits fined millions. South African telecoms tell the big tech giants it's time to chip in and pay for upgrades and maintenance. And small business is on the brink, half warning they could shut their doors within a year. It's Monday, the 11th of August. Now, the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa says food inflation isn't just a number, it's calling it a national emergency. Citing the latest AgBiz report showing prices for essentials like meat, oil and vegetables climbing at their fastest pace in over a year, the union is now accusing big food corporations of profiteering while millions go hungry. Union President Mametlwe Sebe is calling for price controls, nationalization of food monopolies and a 1,500 rand universal basic income grant. And he joins me on the program now, and a very warm welcome. You've called food inflation a national catastrophe, but what evidence do you have that it's driven by profiteering rather than legitimate supply and cost pressures?
Well, thank you, Jeremy. We know from the report from the Competition Commission itself that have actually pointed out that consistently, even when the cost pressures that justified increases comes down, it is not reciprocated by the downward movement of the prices. There's always a lag, which lag between the prices in the retail market, but also from the food industry in general, and those very cost of production reflect the tendency towards, you know, profiteering at the time when people are starving, people are hungry, and of course, a whole generation of children have been stunted in their growth. But we also know for a fact, right, from just a differences in terms of what ordinary farmers are also selling, and of course, what we are ultimately paying in the market. Many of the farmers, by the way, I mean, are going bankrupt and insolvent, because lack of state support simply means that for some, they have to rely on the futures markets, the speculation. That means that what they produce, you know, is sold probably 10, 20 times in the markets, you know, in the, you know, financial markets before you and I get to buy it, with each buyer obviously eating a marker that makes this food unaffordable. No. So there is a generous problem there.
Now, as far as the supply chain is concerned, you blame corporate monopolies, but aren't they also critical to maintaining large-scale supply chains that feed millions of people daily?
I mean, Jeremy, you're talking about the food industry that prefer to throw away 10 million tons of food. That is 65 billion rand food worth of food yearly. In the country where people are literally dying of hunger, I mean, dying of hunger and starvation. And we also know, I mean, just look at the retail industry as an example of that, right? Their CEOs, the CEO of Pick n Pay, Woolworths, ShopRite, are always in the top five of the most outrageously paid CEOs in a country where food is simply unaffordable. Never mind the fact that they are obviously also underpaying their own tellers and so on and so on. There is just no correlation to what they are paying and, of course, what you consider reasonable in a country like ours and so on.
You talk about 10 million tons of food being destroyed annually. Where do you get that figure?
No, that figure is there. I mean,
well, where is it?
Even I think if you just do a basic Google search, I think the Stats SA would have probably also provided that figure. But I know that Oxfam reports have consistently pointed that out as well.
Seems like a very high figure to me.
It is not disputed. You do a basic Google check, you'll be able to see that figure.
You're also calling for nationalization of farms, of food manufacturers and retailers. It's a radical step. The challenge there would be to ensure efficiency and productivity as well as investment under state control. How do you justify that?
Well, we are not talking about the state control in a way that people actually are accustomed to it with, you know, your Eskom and other state-owned enterprises that are run down by corrupt politicians and, of course, you know, officials and so on, you know, top-down bureaucratic management that facilitate looting. We are saying under a democratic control and management of the workers and communities. That means the actual farmers that are the workers and the technical staffs and the managers of these entities democratically run these farms in a way that, of course, we've also seen before. I mean, there have been examples of cooperations here, I mean, of cooperatives in this country that demonstrate that actually you could have a collective forms of ownership. People forget, by the way, that even company like, you know, Clover, we developed out of the farmers cooperative until 1987. I think it remained that. And one of the most successful, obviously, at the time, to the exclusion of many black working class people, it was white farmers cooperatives. But nonetheless, it's a demonstration of what is possible when you have social forms of ownership, but also a democratic control of the industry by those that actually do the work to build an industry that can work not only in the interest of their workers, but actually in the interest of society.
Now,
that
your union is
to feed the hungry and the starving and not for the profiteering of the few monopolies.
Your union is also calling for price controls, but historically that kind of system often leads to shortages and also the emergence of a black market. How would you avoid that?
It is not true, Jeremy. I mean, fuel in this country is price controlled, right? Medicines in this country is price controlled. There is no evidence that anybody has ever went to a petrol station and not find petrol simply because of price control, or a pharmaceutical firm, a pharmacy and so on and so on because of that, right? The issue is that there are many countless other examples of that. I've just given two industries that are not state-owned, but there are many others. I mean, you know, electricity price and other things and so on. So there is really no reason to believe that such industries do not work. If, in fact, before, I think in the 80s, before, I mean, with the advent of this, you know, ANC government, you know, prices of bread and other basic staples used to be controlled. You have a situation here, Jeremy, where the people in this country are dying, and of course, out of hunger, and whole generation of young people are being stunted in their growth in a country that is producing more than enough carbohydrates, as well as, of course, you know, bodybuilding proteins and essentials.
Let me ask you one final question and a short answer, please. How do you respond to critics who say your proposals are outdated? They focus on redistribution rather than growing food production and the economy.
Well, I mean, they miss a point. Part of the problem is that it is exactly the consolidation, the concentration and monopolization of the agricultural production, in this case, by 12,000 of the 32,000 commercial farms that are responsible for over 80% of agricultural production, the top 10 food manufacturing companies that control over 80%, that are responsible for over 80% of the earnings in the industry, and few big retailers that are paying their CEOs outrageously, whilst we're starving, that has landed us in this situation where 65 billion worth of food goes to waste, where millions of people are hungry, and of course, hundreds are dying of starvation in a country that produces more than enough that we need to feed everybody else.
Thank you very much indeed. From the General Industries Workers Union, that's the President Mametlwe Sebe.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, new emission rules could mean jail time for corporate leaders. South Africa is set to bring in tougher climate enforcement, and that effectively means that companies breaching carbon emission standards could see executives fined or even imprisoned, while exceeding limits may trigger heightened carbon tax rates. I'm in conversation now with Geraldine Morris, who's co-head of Africa at the Carbon Trust, who says these proposed regulations are expected to take effect early next year and rise above current global carbon measures, pushing businesses to act rather than delay. Geraldine, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe just as an overview, explain to us why these new rules are important.
Thanks, Jeremy. I think important to clarify that the penalties are not actually a new instrument. These have been in place in the primary legislation, the National Environmental Management Act. And they are the penalties, mostly administrative, for companies who do not provide the information required to manage their environmental considerations, and including, in this case, greenhouse gas emission limits. And so we do currently have in place the pollution prevention plans. So these are the current instruments that many companies have had to comply with since around 2009. And many of these penalties are indeed the same. So it's not a new instrument, thankfully. But I do think it is important as part of the suite of measures to drive the action. The real stick, if I can call it that, is that the higher tax, the higher carbon tax that would be imposed on companies if they fail to stick within their carbon budgets and exceed those limits within the five-year rolling period.
Geraldine, typically, how do companies rank in this country with disclosure of that important information?
I think the disclosure is not so much the problem. There has been the requirement to report greenhouse gas emissions since 2017. It's not necessarily public in all instances. There is some sensitive information that is disclosed to government. So, as I say, not necessarily always made public, but companies are pretty good at reporting their emissions as they need to. It's really just managing those emissions down that I think is quite challenging for many South African entities, particularly those in what we call the hard to abate sectors, where carbon is inherently part of the process of what they do. So, for example, steel making.
But given, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that companies like Sasol and Eskom account for something like 60% of emissions, the regulations can't really transform the broader industrial sector dynamic, or can it?
I think it can, particularly in the case of Eskom. You know, while there are obviously critical just transition considerations in terms of the workers and communities that are currently reliant on the coal value chain for the economic sustainability, from a technological point of view, and even from a financial point of view, electricity decarbonization is really a low-hanging fruit. There are many, many interventions that can come into play, many of which are already incorporated into our policies and plans going forward. So bringing in more renewable energy, more battery storage, and just generally decarbonizing the grid. So Eskom is certainly able to decarbonize in line with our long-term view, net zero emission targets at mid-century, and they are a critical source of emissions in the economy. So tackling those will make a huge difference and is eminently possible. Sasol is obviously a much more complex beast, but they also, I believe, have some mitigation interventions that they are looking to bring into how they do their business over time as well. They have certainly stated that they aim to still meet their commitments in terms of their decarbonization targets that they've put forward in their annual report.
There is the argument that higher carbon taxes and even the threat of fines or jails could scare away foreign investment. How does one balance enforcement, which is critical, and as you've outlined to me, with the competing imperative of economic competitiveness?
I think it would actually help us remain more competitive. So we currently, as a country, our overall carbon price, so if you look at the collection of kind of a carbon budget system, which effectively puts a cap on emissions, and then the higher carbon tax, which prices those emissions in exceedance. We do have a current or a standard carbon tax, which is quite low in international terms. International carbon prices are around $80 per ton. Ours is much, much lower than that. And we also currently have many allowances in our carbon tax regime. So companies can, in some instances, qualify for up to a 95% reduction in their carbon tax liability. So our current carbon tax is pretty weak in terms of being an instrument to drive behavioral change. So having this potential higher penalty creates an incentive for companies to actually implement mitigation opportunities and reduce their emissions. And it will also, I believe, bring our overall carbon price more in line with international standards. Now, why that makes us potentially more competitive is if you look at an instrument like the Carbon Border Tax Adjustment or CBAM that Europe is looking to introduce more stringently from next year. That basically says that any goods that are a higher carbon intensity than the standard set in the EU will be subject to this border adjustment tax. And so importers from a European side will look to ensure that the goods that they import are low carbon, because they will otherwise be liable for the difference between what our carbon price is and what the European carbon price is. So if our price is more in line with that price, and if we look to decarbonize the goods that we export to Europe, then we will be able to remain a key importer into that, or exporter rather, into that market. So it makes us actually more competitive than less.
And how difficult is it going to be for government to ensure both fairness and transparency in enforcement to prevent arbitrary or even politically motivated prosecutions, which is a risk?
Yes, I guess it could be. But having said that, and I read through, you know, these draft regulations and all the way through existing regulations and up to the main Environmental Management Act, and they are mechanisms for appeals. So this isn't a summary thing. It's also important to note that the legislation is very clear that the imposition of these fines and imprisonment is on conviction of the various offences that are listed. And so this, as I say, is not just kind of like a summary instance where somebody comes along and decides you're non-compliant and, you know, hits you with a fine. There are requirements that have to be met. There are processes and appeal processes within the legislation. So it's quite a long way between potential infringement and the penalties actually being enforced. I think DFFE in particular, the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment, in my experience, is also a very reasonable department in terms of engaging with stakeholders. They're very good at working with different stakeholders to ensure that actions happen. So even in the setting of these carbon budgets, in the first instance, for the first 5 years, the draft regulations specifically state that it will be based on the current pollution prevention plan. So these are already in place. Companies are already looking to comply with these. So they won't suddenly be this new, really rigorous, unattainable imposition of a budget that companies would struggle to comply with, therefore, you know, run a risk of running afoul of these things. So I think all the processes within the laws as they're written, and I think also within our judiciary, can help safeguard from that kind of malicious prosecution.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Geraldine Morris from the Carbon Trust. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa's telecom operators, I read, are turning to the so-called over-the-top giants, think Netflix, Showmax, even YouTube, and asking them to foot part of the bill for extending and maintaining national network infrastructure. What's their argument? Well, these platforms obviously profit from driving vast internet traffic, but as I understand it, don't contribute to the costs of keeping those very networks running. What an interesting issue. Well, I'm going to talk about it with Duncan MacLeod, who is the editor at Tech Central. And let's talk about the so-called fair share debate and what it could mean for consumers, the digital economy, and also, I guess, regulation. So, Duncan, a very warm welcome. Always good to talk to you. These large traffic generators, why are telecoms targeting them right now?
Hi, Jeremy. So I think this comes out of Europe, where operators have been lobbying very hard for this concept of fair share. They say that these so-called large traffic generators, these are companies like Netflix, Disney, Google, Apple, Microsoft, companies that send large software updates or are in the streaming video game, consumes a large amount of data. They argue that these companies should actually be paying what they call their fair share, in other words, paying the telecommunications operators to carry some of this traffic across their networks, saying that they're having a big impact on the quality and cost of associated with delivering these services to end users. And they've been lobbying hard for this in Europe, in the EU. But actually, just in the last few days, the European Commission has said that it does not agree with this lobbying, with the viewpoint put across by the likes of Deutsche Telekom, Orange, Telefonica, and others, and have rejected it. They so it looks like it's pretty much dead in Europe. But the South African operators have been lobbying through their industry association, ACT, or the Association for Comms and Technology. They've been lobbying policymakers and regulators in South Africa for a similar sort of arrangement here. I think, Jeremy, where this comes from is that telecommunications operators, particularly in Europe, have been under incredible margin pressure in recent years, particularly in Europe, I think, because it's a heavily regulated market, and they don't have the opportunity to push up pricing, and perhaps they could do in other markets because of those regulations. So I think what we're seeing here is that telcos are becoming, or they fear becoming, the so-called dumb pipes of the internet, basically the infrastructure providers that deliver the high-margin value-adding services on top of that infrastructure, your likes of Netflix, etc., that are delivering content to end users, and they want a slice of that pie. But I can't see this flying. Consumers are already paying for their internet connections. The infrastructure is in place, and these so-called LTGs, large traffic generators, actually do contribute a lot to infrastructure. We know that Meta Platforms, for example, is investing extensively in undersea cable infrastructure. We know that Google is investing in undersea infrastructure around Africa and in terrestrial networks as well. So I think there's going to be a lot of pushback from the content providers to the telcos. And honestly, I can't see this flying in South Africa.
Duncan, do we have a sense of what the telcos, the likes of Vodacom and MTN, actually spend annually on those infrastructure upgrades?
Well, we know how much they spend on CapEx every year, the amount of money they put into their networks. MTN and Vodacom spend in the region very roughly of about 10 billion rand a year each. So it's not small amounts of money, but by the same token, they charge their end-user customers for access to that infrastructure. So you and me, we pay for our fiber connection at home in order to watch Netflix over that fiber connection. What in effect they want to do is erect a toll gate between themselves and the consumer who's buying the Netflix, or between the consumer and the large traffic generator, as they call them, and collect a fee from those companies like Netflix. And they argue that they need this to continue to fund the infrastructure rollout. But the fact is they already charge end users for access to the network. So it's all very curious to me. They'll put forward a lot of technical regulatory arguments about why it makes sense. But as we've seen in Europe, it's been rejected. And I think we're going to see the same thing happen here.
Where do you think government might stand on this issue?
It's hard to know. I think we'll probably end up falling in line with the Europeans. I don't think our Minister of Communications has expressed any views on this at the moment. I have heard that the regulators are not that keen, and local regulators are not that keen on it, though I haven't engaged with them directly on the subject. So, yeah, I, I think let's put it this way. I think the telcos, if they want to get this through, have got an uphill battle on their hands to convince regulators and policymakers that it actually makes sense.
Just theoretically, though, the fair share model, if it were to go ahead, whether we're talking about Europe or South Africa, surely has the potential, Duncan, to derail innovation or investment in that digital space.
I think what it could do is drive up prices for you and me. You know, if Netflix, for example, is required to pay this fee to the network operators to provide services in South Africa, then, you know, they're going to pass that on to someone, and that someone is going to be you and me, because we're the ones who contract with those companies for those streaming services. So I think at the end of the day, if the telcos are successful in their lobbying and a fee like this is introduced into the South African market, that the net result will be that we pay more for our Showmax and Netflix subscriptions.
Do you think the telcos locally are going to continue to push this argument in spite of the fact that it's found no success in Europe?
Well, they've certainly been lobbying very hard up until this point. So I think the decision by the European Commission is a blow to their lobbying efforts here. But I've seen no indication yet that they're going to abandon this lobbying. I would expect it to continue, because I think they expect they can get an outcome out of it. But I think the developments in Europe probably are a bit of a blow to their lobbying efforts locally.
Yeah, please don't mess with our Netflix. Duncan McLeod, thank you very much indeed. Editor of Tech Central. I appreciate you unpacking and explaining that argument. Thanks a lot.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's small business sector, it would seem, is teetering on the brink. A new Small Business Growth Index survey shows that more than half of small enterprises, over 55%, may not survive the next 12 months under current economic pressure. What's the problem? Well, rising costs in transport, utilities and raw materials are pushing firms into a very vulnerable zone, while many scramble to stay afloat. Yet the report also reveals, I'm pleased to say, a flicker of resilience. Around a quarter of businesses continue growing. 80% say they are still planning to invest in expansion. So let's make some sense of this report. I'm in conversation with Linda Mbanjwa, Head of Strategic Business Development at Absa Business Banking. Linda, a very warm welcome. So we have an index score of 51.08. That puts SMEs in what I've just described as a vulnerable position or a vulnerable zone. What does that actually mean, though?
So Jeremy, what it means is that if you think about it, 5 in 10 businesses are saying that they currently in decline. They're saying that they're in distress. And that's obviously given the environment that they're operating in. And I think you touched on quite a few key elements that are kind of driving some of the distress that we are seeing. Case in point, obviously cost inflation is one of those things that's really, really driving a challenge for these businesses. Wages have gone up, obviously. Input costs are causing quite a bit of strain. If you look at transport, I mean, 6 out of 10 businesses are citing transport costs as something that's really, really becoming a problem. Utilities, obviously, as we've noted, have been increasing, obviously, over the last 12 months as well. And now they're starting to really, really put some real strain in terms of at least how the businesses are experiencing that. Raw materials as well is cited by at least over 2% of these businesses as things that are also starting to obviously rise. Naturally, when you've got rises in transport costs, everything generally will follow that trend. And then from a financing perspective as well, I think from a financial sector perspective, we are noticing the pressure that these businesses are feeling. And it was interesting that it also came out in a survey through their voices that they feel that the financing costs are starting to really, really, really escalate, which is obviously causing them a headache as well. So just citing all of those things, Jeremy, you then also look at things like skills that they've also cited. So, to effectively manage a business, there's certain core skills that you need to have. And most of these businesses rated skills as average and obviously requiring very targeted, let's call it interventions in terms of how we actually enable and develop those. Digital processes as well. A lot of these businesses aren't necessarily well equipped from a digital perspective. And that's an area where you need to start looking at how we upskill from a skills perspective. Cybersecurity then becomes an issue that follows on once people start playing in the digital realm. And I guess that's also one of the detractors, right, for a lot of these businesses to actually just start obviously exploring the digital aspect a lot more. So embracing new technologies is going to be quite key. There was a bit of insights that also came through as well from a sales perspective and business development, where some of these businesses are citing that they could actually use assistance in terms of upskilling in those areas as well.
Linda, what I find staggering about this survey is that over 55% of small businesses may not survive over the next 12 months. That would have a staggering impact on the economy and most notably jobs.
Absolutely. So it's a huge stat, right? And it's backed by a couple of things. I think one of the issues I'll touch that's actually driving, I suppose, that sentiment is the aspects of cash flow management. Now, we all understand that cash flow is important for basically running a business, managing financial obligations. And a lot of these businesses are struggling at a cash flow perspective. I think the other thing, obviously, that impacts that is obviously access to finance and funding. So a lot of these businesses are not able to access finance or funding. And we're finding that at least 40% of these businesses are using what I would term as non-fit-for-purpose financing vehicles. Basically, the informal financing vehicles that are not necessarily regulated, which is not necessarily going to help their cause. Mm. Some of them are actually using their own cash as well in terms of just making sure that they stay afloat. And obviously, that does put a bit of strain. In terms of obviously the headcount piece, I think a lot of them have managed to actually keep their headcount, while I think a certain percentage of as well have actually noted a bit of a contraction from a staff perspective. And obviously, if things don't improve, if interventions aren't put in place to enable these businesses, we're going to definitely see a lot more hemorrhaging of jobs, which is not what we want to see. I mean, if you look at, let's call it the well-versed economies or the first world economies, small business is the bloodline of those economies. They provide the jobs that are required by society. So that's something that we need to look at a lot more closely as well.
Let's talk about intervention in just a moment. But you talk about access to funding, which suggests that banks themselves are going to have to change their approach. But it also means that you're going to have to take a different stance, surely, on risk modeling.
Absolutely. So I think we as banks have a responsibility as well to start looking at how we structure lending, especially more so for businesses of this nature, right? I mean, a lot of these businesses, you're going to find that they're in the townships. A lot of them, you're going to find that they are in rural areas, right? So as banks, we need to start looking at things differently in terms of how we structure, to your point, how we finance these businesses. I think blended financing options need to start becoming a lot more prominent in terms of where we look at both grant funding over and above just your normal traditional lending in terms of how you service these areas of the market. I think collaborations as well with, let's call it fintechs, who kind of make it easy for us to be able to gather the data that we need in order to make informed assessments around how we actually advance funds to these businesses is going to be a lot more critical for banks to kind of play a bigger role in.
But the problem is that banks are not doing that with enough alacrity.
Yeah, hence we're saying, I think for us, it's about surfacing these issues, putting them forward. The report is a public report. It's for all financial institutions to actually start looking at it, thinking about it differently. Additionally, as well, I think at a policy level, I guess we're one of the countries that's fairly lucky in the sense that we've got a Ministry of Small Business, right? And having a Ministry of Small Business is one thing. But they've been one of the ministries that is actually forthcoming in terms of trying to collaborate with private sector. And I guess that's where, for me, things become a lot more interesting, because that collaboration, if we can influence policy, that drives a different thought of, or rather approach to thinking and to solutioning for these problems. These problems are not necessarily banking problems. They're not necessarily, let's call it, the government's problems. They're our problems as a country, and we need to collaborate in terms of how we approach and actually start solutioning for them.
So let's talk a little bit about influencing policy. That's an interesting point. What role, then, do you think government should be playing in that respect versus private sector and intermediary involvement?
So the expectation that we have, right, I think we're fortunate that we find ourselves in a year of the G20. EFSA as a bank is also part of the Startup 20, and we're highly involved in all the work that's building up to policy and shaping at least what we feel is important, especially when you consider the context of SMEs. So definitely from our end, we're going to be taking this report, some of the insights that sit in here and some of the recommendations, and we're going to drive those in the Startup 20 to make sure that we actually influence how government kind of then receives and shapes policy going forward in terms of how we kind of approach the segment of small business.
I keep coming back to that figure. 55% of small businesses may not survive the next 12 months under current economic pressure. It is a very sobering analysis. Linda Mbanjwa, thank you very much indeed. Head of Strategic Business Development at Absa Business Banking. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.